Anyway, my name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic. Good evening, Cartersville. All right. My sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004, so I just picked up 19 years in this last month. As John said, I've been involved in a lot of audio talks, and there is a site called WeJoy.org that I'll talk about a little bit. And I've told a lot of my story about, you know, how I came into the program, and I've looked back on it, and I've told it many, many times. And I will probably refer you there if you would like to know a lot of the details about that. But I felt inspired today to maybe talk about attraction in this program and about some stories in AA. And as I was telling John, if you've been here 19 years and you don't have some stories in AA, you've been under a rock somewhere. But I will do a brief qualification. I was born in 1955 in Atlanta. I'm one of those rare natives, although one of my guys I sponsored, he was born right in the heart of Atlanta, and I was born in about three doors down from Atlanta in East Point. So I was three doors away from being, in his mind, an Atlanta native. But anyway, I was one of those child of the 60s, and they say if you were you remember the 60s, you weren't even there probably. I was a guy who I think I sniffed glue when I was 8. My sister turned me on to marijuana when I was 10 as a step up, and then we drank to get drunk at 12. But I was also a guy who in the late 70s just set the marijuana aside, and all the, you know, the circle disappeared except those who were really true friends, you know. I'm not a guy who drank alcoholically during the 80s. I am a guy who, at one of those hippies at 15, asked me, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? It's a very interesting question for 15. And it'd be like, well, if I was born in Saudi Arabia, I'd be Islam. If I was born in India, I'd be Sikh or Hindu or Muslim. And so I really began a search for, you know, what is truth? You know, and I think in a lot of ways, so many of us come in with that. And I think AA actually provides us with not the answers, but the way to ask the question. When you look at the fourth step, what is my part? You know, how about, I can drink, I can quit on my own. Is that true? You know, I can manage my life. If I think my life is my circumstances, and if I get all these circumstances right and I get them to stay put, then my life will be manageable. The problem is, have you ever had circumstances stay put? They, you know, I guess this mug, if I left this here and nobody touched it and we came back, it'd still be there. But this, we're dealing with relationships and people and complex. No, man, it's what I found out in the program, the real true thing is I don't need to fix my circumstances. I need to learn a way to respond appropriately to whatever circumstances happen to come my way. I'm a guy who, my son was, I wound up going to Colorado State after, I was one of those, anybody else have a lot of promise, you know, and a lot of potential if you only applied yourself? Anybody else? It was told, I get waves back there, you know, and I'm one of those who had my parents sent me to a private school, and because in third grade, they took me to a child psychologist who said he's just bored, and they sent me to a private school, and they were not rich people, and they sacrificed a lot in order to send me there, and I didn't really appreciate it. You know, how much of that have we done? You know, had all of these opportunities and never really appreciated and never took real advantage of them. But I did. My parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to a small town in Alabama. Now, they were inviting me over there. You know, they had a place for me. But I used to hitchhike to downtown Atlanta, you know, instead of going to school, climb around in the skyscrapers and do all that. There was I don't know. Anybody else here got pleasure by sneaking around? You know, I think my old definition of success was I got away with it again. You know, what a great definition of success, you know, and I was doing that for quite a while. But anyway, I I lived for a year in downtown Atlanta, and I came to the conclusion that it was a pretty good idea to get a college education, and all of a sudden it was my idea, and I decided to apply myself because I began to see the urban world down there and what it really held in store. And so I went and did move to Alabama and went to school there, and I just finally blew it away because, well, the school down there was kind of the extension of Alabama High School, and I had gone to a college prep school, but I did apply myself, and my parents were pleased with that and said, you can go just about anywhere. I called up long-distance information. It used to be the area code and then 555-1212, something like that. But anyway, you call that up, and you'd get information, and I asked them, what colleges do you have in Colorado? And they said, Colorado and Colorado State. And I said, hold on, because they were about to give me a list. And I picked a penny out of my pocket, and I flipped it, and it was tails, and I went to Colorado State. And the first week I was there, I butted into a conversation of two ladies sitting on a couch, and one of those ladies and I are going to celebrate 44 years this next month being married. So we've known each other now for 47. Although I do tell people, I think we just never decided to divorce each other at the same time. You know, there were moments there. But I was one who I kind of applied myself. I was drinking some, in college, not heavily. In fact, there was a guy who was dealing cocaine, and one of the reasons he liked me is I didn't really like cocaine. I liked playing cribbage with him, it was one of those things. So I started applying myself. Actually, I was taking Eastern history, and took history of India, and I actually had a year of Chinese language. I was trying to look around the world, to see what kind of truths do we have that go across continents, that go across cultures, that go around, that go around the world. The real truths that we have and the principles that we have that a lot of clubhouses put up on the walls, I think are things that go across time and across continents and across cultures. Brotherly, love, service, integrity. Those are all things that even you would find if you were, in a gang in a prison. You would probably have to have integrity. You'd have to have honesty within the group. And there's very severe punishments for not doing it. So there are some things that I think are universal principles. So anyway, I wound up, actually, I thought I was going to go into international, got married and we came back to Georgia, and I finished up my degree at Georgia State, and I was going to go into international business, and they had, the marketing department was on the same floor, and they had a thing called the American Marketing Association, and I got involved in that. And found out that the professional group was required to interface with the college group, and we started bringing speakers in and doing all this stuff and getting involved in service, and it grew us. And I wound up taking two computer courses while I was there. I'd never touched a computer before, and I found out that my history degree was a great introduction to programming because history is really the history of things moving through a system, and how people interact with that system. And it was just a natural for me. And I got to get involved with the IBM PCs when they were first coming out in 81, 83, in that area. I was working with databases and doing a number of other things. I wound up getting a job with the Division of Equifax. I got my master's in marketing research, as it turned out, because this was a marketing research company. And they treated me very well, and I went up toward into management, and I had upward of 30 people working for me. Again, I'm not drinking alcoholically. My son was born in 84. I had a daughter born in 89. And I had also, in college, I worked for a year in a nursing home as a nurse's aide, and I got to see people married for 75 years, people 105 years old, 94 years old, and them looking back on their lives. And I got to see the families of these people who handled it well and those families that didn't handle it well. And I actually got quite a schooling in life right there, and that carried me really through the 80s. Well, towards the, my daughter was born in 89, and sometime during the late 80s, early 90s, I began to shift from being this optimist that I always was. My mom's natural state of being was to be of service. That's just who she was. But I started going to being a pessimist in terms of, what's wrong with my life? What's wrong with my wife? What's wrong with this job? But also, I wound up by a couple of circumstances, wound up going to a strip joint in Atlanta and with a guy who was working for me, and they were having a bachelor party. And when I was 6 years old, I had a Pull Your Pants Down Club with a girl down the street, and we were the only two members. So it was something. When I went to this was an adult version of that. And I also said at that point, I'm not getting this at home, you know. And then I went to a massage parlor thinking I was going to get a massage. She offered the full treatment, and I accepted it. But then after that, I started drinking for a purpose. See, before, I wasn't drinking for a purpose. I think an alcoholic is someone who drinks for a purpose. And also, I think an alcoholic is someone who drinks against their will. And that image of this one gal, she was just trying to get sober, and we were over at the Howe place, and she was describing how she was reaching into the refrigerator to grab a beer, and she knew she didn't want it, and she grabbed it anyway and drank it. Can anybody identify with that? Drinking against our will. And what I was doing is I was drinking to cover up my guilt, because my mama raised me better than that. And I started a period there where I would drink for a while. I'd get up to a fifth of vodka a day, then I'd quit. And I'd brush myself off, and then I'd go for days, sometimes months. And then I'd get a little bit restless, a little bit irritable, a little bit discontented, like this pressure cooker, just building up. And then I would change my mind about not drinking. Just have a little. One couldn't hurt. And over again, I like to tell newcomers, whatever you do, do not quit drinking. How many times have you quit drinking? What happened with me on, I had a lot of things go on. I'm just going to cut it short. If you want to hear the rest of it, you can go up there, because I want to get on to some of the amazing people I've met in recovery. But I got to the point, my wife, she didn't know I was drinking. I was smoking cigarettes for 8 to 10 years. She didn't know it. You know? And she wrote me a letter. We're living in the same house. She's sleeping out on the couch. I'm back there. I go to the, if I couldn't walk past her, I'd hang my head out the bathroom, smoke a cigarette like I did when I was 12 years old. And it happened that she had written me a letter saying, we may lose the house. If we do, you may not be invited to the next one. I was just telling her the other day, I've still got that letter, you know, and I thanked her for it. But that was in July of 04. On August the 9th of 04, I decided to quit, because I had told her that I had made an appointment with Kaiser Behavioral Services that week. I had not made the appointment. But I was going to quit anyway, and then try and let the guy I was going to be on Thursday figure out how to do that on Thursday. Well, at 3 o'clock in the morning on Thursday, August the 12th, I was kicking. I had not drank for several days. I was quitting on my own. And at that point, I just smoked a cigarette hanging out the bathroom window, came back in, and I said, I need help. And so probably the first time, and I call it the three-word prayer of an atheist, because not only was I sure there was no God, I was sure I could convince you there's no God. But something happened at that time, and I said, this is like some sort of TV show or a movie or something. Because something shifted in me. Because, see, I was about to lie to my wife again. I was trying to figure out what to tell her this time again. And it was, a couple of around here might be old enough to know who Ed Sullivan was. And they had this famous act on there where they had these poles and there were these spinning plates on it. And this guy could keep all these plates spinning on these poles. And that's what I felt like. I tell you what, I've got a little thing out in my car that says the 12 truths about lying, you know? And it is amazing how much energy it takes to lie, you know, and to keep it all up and not get caught. And I just decided, I said, well, what am I going to stop lying about? And I said, everything. And I got my daughter off to school, my wife kind of woke up, and I got on the couch, and I said, this is the quote, by the way, I've been a son of a bitch. That's what I told her, and I outlined basically what I had been doing, except the smoking cigarettes. But by the way, those were the last two cigarettes that day that I had, that I've had since. Because you see, I didn't quit smoking. I started being a good husband. And my wife's father is a was a cancer surgeon, and she hated smoking worse than any of the other things. But next Tuesday, I told her about it. But I tell you what, I just was so tired of lying. I was willing to go through whatever it took to not have to live that way anymore. And I didn't know. I knew about AA. It just had the God thing in it, so it probably wasn't for me. I did make a list that weekend. It was about 5 pages long of all the things that I needed to do. I showed it to my wife. She says, certainly is a long list, you know. I've gotten through a lot of that list, by the way, in 19 years. I have to go back and check to see if there's any items I've left off. But anyway, I also had a thing going on where in November of 2003, I went to Thanksgiving out in Birmingham, and I've got a family. We get along great. I have no family problems. I have nothing in there that says this is why I'm an alcoholic. You know, I have every reason in the world not to be. And so I went to Thanksgiving, but then I started getting restless, irritable, and discontent, made up an excuse, and drove all the way back from Birmingham to Atlanta by myself, telling them I had some client, something I had to work on I didn't have. And I went to a strip joint and then a massage parlor, and 4 days later I had 105-degree temperature. And when it broke, I started passing gas and debris when I urinated. My body was breaking down. I'll tell you what, alcohol tears up the body. It is probably one of the most dangerous drugs to the body that we know of. You know, you don't get wet brain from heroin, you know. It's amazing. And kidneys and the liver, you know, and the cardiac system, it messes with everything. Well, anyway, so what happened, I had wishful thinking between December and February, and finally in February I went to the doctor, and they wanted to do a test, you know, a swab test thing for sexually transmitted diseases, and I did that, but I wouldn't pee into a cup because I had to drink to drive over there, and I didn't want them to take my solution away. You know, I don't want them to know I'm drinking, because I'll get pleasure by sneaking around, and I'm not ready for you to take my drinking away. I was okay to be married 25 years and have a sexually transmitted disease, but I was not okay for somebody to take my alcohol away and to find out that I drank too much. Bill says that insanity is a lack of proportion when he talks about Jim putting whiskey in the milk, right? And here I was wanting to hold on to my alcohol drink and all my sneaking around, and what was I doing about being a good father, being a good husband, being a good brother, being a good son? So I came in, it turned out, by the way, that actually turned out to be a diverticulitis, and my bladder and my colon had fused together. And it was actually the one symptom that the doctors couldn't figure out that I didn't have is I wasn't dead. Because that's like a gunshot wound in the belly. And somehow it all fused tight right in there. And they fixed it up. I've got I call it a zipper right here, where they took out about a foot and a half of my colon. And that's kind of my, it's kind of my trophy for, like, you know, you win a softball game or something. This is my trophy for having survived alcoholism. So what I want to do is talk about what happened in sobriety for me. I went to behavioral services, and they took me to 8111, and it was on the syllabus to go to AA. And I'd had all these hundreds of hours of college, and I said, okay, I know how to do a syllabus. You just go up there. And I'll tell you what I saw on the wall is I saw those 12 principles, but I also saw the 12 traditions. It was a tradition. I'd been negotiating all these contracts, and I had to learn about organizations very quickly, be able to see them. And I looked at those 12 traditions, and I realized that they had taken away every single excuse I had for being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also realized that that organization, as described in those traditions, is different than any other organization I'd ever been in. And I was fascinated. And it's funny, I came out of that meeting, and by the way, I just went back there a couple of weeks ago to pick up a 19-year chip, and one of the guys who did our group inventory. If you haven't ever done a group inventory, it's fascinating, but he's a past treasurer of Area 16, and he was there at the meeting. And I got to go back and say, 19 years ago, you know, plus 2 days, is when I picked up my white chip here, and it's the only one I've picked up. But when I saw that I came out of that meeting and I called my sister, or she called me, I don't remember which, and she said, oh, well, how long do you have to go to those AA meetings? And I said, for the rest of my life. I have no idea where that came from. I have somehow got an overwhelming willingness to do this program. And after sponsoring a lot of different people, I've never been able to give away a thimbleful of it. Have you ever tried to give away your willingness? If somebody's got it, I can't get them drunk. If somebody doesn't have it, I can't get them sober. And I don't take credit for it either. It's that something that happened. And it's a gift. I find out, though, it's like with any other gift, you treasure it, you know? Just try and treasure that willingness. If you're in here, you know, this time of day, with all the other things you could possibly do, and you've got that willingness to come in here and do it, I would nurture that thing, baby. There is out of 100 alcoholics, about 10 will seriously try to get sober, and somewhere between 3 to 5 will die sober. Those are the numbers. I was working with one of the delegates as we were trying to put together some little idea about the number of members in Alcoholics Anonymous and also some ideas about that, and that's about the best we could come up with. This is no nosebleed, folks. You know? The guy who drinks gets all the benefit. The guy who comes to the next morning pays all the price. I'm going to say that again. The guy who drinks gets all the benefit. And the guy who comes to the next morning pays all the price. I don't want to go back in business with that guy. So I want to go through a couple of names. Steve. Steve was my first sponsor. They told us to get a sponsor at the first meeting that we could get to, but preferably in your own county. So I was down near 400 in Abernathy, where they have behavioral services. So when I came up here, I went to one meeting, the Depot meeting, and I went to the Depot in Kennesaw. You know, it's at Cherokee Street Depot, and there was no meeting there. Turns out it was. Had moved from the depot 5 times since they gave it the depot meeting name. And I asked a police officer, do you know where AA is? No, I don't know where that meeting is. I don't know about that. Next day is, and that was a Friday. The next was a Saturday, and they had a meeting on the schedule that was within walking distance of my house. And I drive over there and sit in the parking lot of this Presbyterian church, and there's no meeting. It turns out it was 300 yards down the road in 2 abandoned trailers marked Lutheran Church. And I went, damn, these people are anonymous. I mean, they're not kidding. And I went the next day to the bookstore with my wife, and I went and bought a retail version of the big book with the stories in it, because they gave me only the little red book, you know, the short one that they give in treatment. And I wanted the whole deal. And I kept that thing and had the retail sticker on it for the longest time, the little barcode on the back, as part of that willingness to go to any lengths, you know. And I had my big book, you know. And finally, I found this meeting on Monday night. First guy that made any sense to me, to the right, I just asked him to be my sponsor. And because I'm checking the list again, you know. And so I go outside and he says, do you believe in God? And I said, nope. He said, how about a power greater than yourself? And I said, don't think so. He said, let me get this straight. You're the most powerful thing in the universe? And I had to give that a little thought. And I said, well, probably not. And he went, at least there's some hope, you know? And he said, I only know one way to do this, and that's by the book. Thank God. And he took me through the book, and he took me through the steps. And I remember being doing my fourth step on the July 1st, and having taken my fourth step, and I took it out and burned it in the parking lot as part of the fireworks. Later on, I read, you're going to need that list in step 8. I thought, well, I know the author, so maybe. But in November of 05, I get a call from Steve. And he goes, hey, I'm having a heart attack. He says, don't worry about it, and don't worry about coming to the hospital. My family's going to be down there. Hey, but you know that guy that you just started sponsoring? I think you need to do this and this and this with him. And I'm like, this guy's on the ball, you know? And that was, and December 16th of 2005, Steve died of pleurisy and complications from heart. And by the way, that November call when he called me, my son was there. And my son didn't come over to the house all that often, you know, but he just happened to be there. And when he went back to his apartment, his roommate came out and said, I got to go to the hospital. My dad's had a heart attack. What's his name? Steve. Steve's son and my son were roommates, and we didn't know it. And that's how I randomly picked my sponsor. My sponsor introduced me to his sponsor within the first week of my sobriety, of knowing him, not my sobriety, because it was like the whole week beforehand. And that gentleman is some 40 years sober and is still my sponsor today. And let's talk about WeJoy. One of the guys who was sober before I came in, but drank a little bit after I did, and so we're kind of classmates in the same area. But he had gone down, and he's a lawyer, and I was doing some work on a servers for him. I was starting to get back into work to get responsible again. Because during that last year, I was not working. I was not earning any money. I was living off my wife's paycheck. And I pawned my, get this, I pawned my Les Paul at Dirt Cheap Music. Now, you don't pawn at Dirt Cheap. You pawn at Buckhead. You know, but I don't know, that's what you get for alcoholic thinking, you know. So later on, by the way, in sobriety, I replaced that guitar, and that's sort of my symbol of making amends to me. But anyway, he had gone in July, that was before I got sober, to Dallas, Texas, to a roundup called the Gathering of Eagles, and he had brought back a CD by a guy named Ed M. out of Bittendorf, Iowa. And Ed's story of forgiveness made the national news. I had not known that at the time. All I knew is that it looked like it was copyrighted. And in my business law course, I did a paper on copyright infringement law because I wanted to know how to get away with it, because I was copying software and all kinds of stuff. And so I'm thinking, this guy's kind of a hypocrite. He's in the program and he wants me to copy some copyrighted stuff, you know? And also, I thought, man, you're lazy. You don't want me to show you how to copy. You want, and also cheap. You know, he's got this big car, house, and he's one CD. He could bring two cases back. You know, real easy. No, one CD. So okay, fine. So I make a copy, and I hear this story, and I go, that's cool. Let me burn a few more copies. You know, and so I hand out a couple of them. I think, you know, should I sell them? And I went, I don't think I want a bunch of alcoholics checking my balance sheet, you know, that doesn't sound very good. So I would tell people, just bring me blank CDs, you know, or sleeves or something. And and then Santa Claus came and told his story. He's no longer with us, John Cornelius. Did anybody ever hear John talk before? John was, but he had two recordings of himself on cassette, and he said, can you convert these to CD? And I went, you know, while I'm capable of conversing with inanimate objects, I think it's on my resume somewhere. And so I figured out how to do it. And another great story. It's also on WeJoy, but one of the ones that started the whole thing out. And so I started handing out those CDs. And somebody would say, well, where'd you get those from? And I said, well, I took them off a cassette. I've got a whole closet full of these things, you know, and my tape's broken. Can you convert them over and just get me? So all of a sudden, I've got Joe and Charlie's Big Book Study. I've got Clancy. I've got Sandy Beach. I've got Karen. I've got June G. I've got all of, you know, all these really great speakers, and I'm listening to them because, you know, as I go in the car, and this is some great brainwashing, you know. It really is. I came in with a very dirty brain. And I'll tell you what, I just hear those stories over and over again. And I think it's, we are really story people. You know, we remember stories more than we remember any facts. And that's part of what I'm doing right now, is to tell you the stories. Let me tell you what, just about every kind of service that I've done has started out with no. And then hell no. And then, all right. And then, don't take it from me. You know, it becomes so important in my sobriety. And the only one that didn't work with, by the way, We Joy is two of the key concepts for me in the program. I did not get that name for like putting on the web. I just would write it on the CD so I could tell mine from anybody else's that might be out there. And then it struck me to put it up on the web to make it available. And I said, wejoy.org. That's only 5 characters. I mean, surely that's taken, and it was not. So that's what has happened. And it's just been gradual process of people donating them in, me converting them over, and gradually putting them up. And just this past summer, it hit 3,000 talks that are on there. And I'll tell you what, I have benefited so much from that, you know. And just and one of my favorite stories about that is the guy who had a real bad business trip and things were all going wrong, and he gets up to Washington, D.C., finally gets in his rental car, starts it up, and there's a WeJoy CD in there. And he starts laughing, and it just turns his day around, you know? It has given back so many different ways to me. And so many people know me a lot better than I know other people just because of that. You know, hey, that's the guy that handed me the CD. The jail meetings and Mr. Ed. To say somebody is a character in AA is really saying something. You know? Mr. Ed was a character. But he was a guy who, I saw him at the North Marietta AA meeting, got this goatee. By the way, whenever he read the traditions, he would always laugh when he started talking about AA should never be organized. And his statement was, we're in no danger of that. But he's the one who got me interested in it. Looked, it was appealing. He was attractive about this idea about going to the jail meeting. I mean, he lost my copy of my driver's license, you know, and I had to go back again and go get it. So this is one of those I really sought out going to that jail meeting. And it was every Monday night, and I guess I did that for at least 10 years. In 2010 or 11 and 12, I think it was. And sometime in that time, we were pulled out of the main part of the jail, actually because of PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, required that the deputies have two of them escorting us, and they just didn't have the personnel to do it. We started doing, after that, the work release. But I remember going into that jail meeting, and we had a big book study. It would be an open discussion, big book study, open discussion, big book, every other week. And there is nothing to get you to learn the big book than to read it with somebody who's new and shaken, and really these guys were motivated to need it, and they didn't want to hear any fluffy stuff. They wanted to see how it was applying in our lives, you know, on that day. And it really solidified this program in me. This is the idea that the teacher learns 3 times as much as the student, because I have to think it, I have to speak it, and then I get to hear myself say it. And so that was another one of those that we would go in there on Christmas Eve. And these guys were not thinking we were going to have a meeting on Christmas Eve, but my family knew that that was very important, and we would make sure that we made it in there. Again, one of those things where I was being of service and I got so much more in return. And I got to be there for old Mr. Ed, and I thought he was this lonely old soul, and went to his celebration of life, and he had all these young ladies there that just loved him. he was truly one of the characters. Jim D. Jim D. is a guy who passed away with 52 years sober. He was a newscaster on the weekends on Cleveland television as an alcoholic. And he had to drink enough so his hands wouldn't shake, and not too much so he'd slur his words. and do that twice on the weekend. I try and do that one, right? He said he wasn't always too successful, you know. Jim wind up getting sober with Sister Ignatia in Rosary Hall. And he's got a great story. It's also on WeJoy. But I got him to sit down and talk about what Sister Ignatia was like. By the way, he also worked with a guy named Tom Conway who had to change his name to Tim because there was already a Tom Conway. If anybody's ever heard Tim Conway, the comedian, he said he was like that guy all the time. He actually went to an AA meeting with Duke Ellington. He went just a fascinating guy. He actually wound up getting an Emmy in sobriety for doing a program called America Roads. And it was where they would be a travel show, but he would also go around the world with these different travel groups. And he would hit AA meetings around the world and just had some fantastic stories. But I'll tell you what Jim was, most of all. It was gentleness of spirit. He was just very gentle with me when I first came in. There's a guy named Courtney Baylor who was actually the lay therapist who was treating Roland Hazard when Roland Hazard passed the program on to Ebby Thatcher. Courtney Baylor was a survivor of the an alcoholic who got sober through what was called the Emanuel Movement in Boston, which we actually owe a lot of debt of gratitude towards. Look it up sometime, Emanuel Movement in Boston. But he wrote a book called Remaking a Man, and in that book he said, we have to get the tenseness out of the alcoholic. Isn't that great? We have to get the tenseness out of the alcoholic. And that's why that gentleness sometimes, you know. We come in here, we've been through a lot of hard knocks. We've had a lot of people yelling at us. We've had a lot of people telling us everything we should do. And one of my mentors, Pat H., He passed away with 35 years of program. He got of sobriety. He got sober with Chuck Chamberlain and all those folks out in Los Angeles. But he would say, give them strokes, not pokes. You know? And these are the people that I got to see him, you know, and his family. One of the things I do is I help people repair their desktop computers or laptops or whatever within the program. And so I got to see him, you know, interfacing with his wife. And I'd see him get a little angry, but then he'd quickly jump and use the steps and see him recover, you know, and actually see people practicing these principles in all their affairs. And it was service, again, that got me out of the house, not just sitting reading books about it, but get out of the house and actually see people practicing this stuff in their daily lives. And I could see that this could work for me, too. One of the things I did is I always knew that I kind of wanted to get back into service. And in 2004, I saw an ad in a little local newspaper about non-medical home health care, where you could just take care of the elderly in their homes. And I started working for them. In fact, it was funny. The guy offered me the job after I'd done the interview. I said, I'm about to go into a meeting. He said, what kind of meeting? And I said, AA. And later on, when he came down before hiring me, he said, tell me a little more about this with AA. And I told him the truth. And I'm only sober 3 months or so. This guy took a chance on me. And the first job I got was with an elderly couple. And it was Pauline and Bailey. And Miss Pauline, her question for me was how quickly I could get upstairs and make the beds. And I started going up the stairs, and her daughter pulled me back and said, no, not just yet. But my job was like to clean the bathrooms, make the bed, do the laundry, you know, cook them some lunch or whatever. Well, anyway, this was November of 04, and in July of 05, they both got flu. And Pauline recovered, but Bailey did not. And I remember taking Bailey up the steps one day, and he goes, well, this is probably the last time I'll be going up these steps, you know. This was a guy who had to quit school when he was 8 years old to go back to work in the cotton fields in North Forsyth County. And they used to have to take the mule wagons into Gainesville. And the Gainesville's 20 miles from there. And I can still hear him say, and a mule goes 4 miles an hour. Take them 5 hours to get in there. Here we are. You know, 20 minutes, we're on the other side of town, you know. But I tell you what, Bailey, we were starting to take care of him multiple days a week, but I could only really do one or two because my business had started picking up. I started a new business. And so I got there about 9:30. I was expected at 10, but I got there a little bit early. And she was so relieved, the daughter, because he had been up and down all night. And I just sat and decided to talk with him. And Pauline's actually listening in, and he starts going through for an hour and a half talking about his life. And at the end of it, turned out to be the last lucid conversation this man had on this earth. And he said, "Well, I got the nurses coming to take care of me in the evening. I got you coming to take care of me in the morning. Not bad for an old plowboy." And you know what? Old Bailey taught me a great lesson, because every night he could lay his head on his pillow and say, "Not bad for an old plowboy." He was a one-day-at-a-time guy. And this guy didn't know I was in AA. He didn't have any trouble with alcohol, but he had a skill for living. And when I start getting attuned to listen to skill for living inside the rooms, I can start listening for it outside the rooms. My mom was diagnosed with lung cancer, and then they looked like they cleared it up, and it came back. And I was listening to Sandy Beach. I was at the Woodstock of the South, and he was doing a little talk on the 12 and 12, and where it says, it's a spiritual axiom that whenever we are disturbed, there is something wrong with us. And I decided at that point not to plan my grief. I decided not to plan my grief. And I got to be there for my mom, and I got to be not one of her problems, because she knew I was okay. She was born again Pentecostal. She knew exactly where she was going. And I said, "Well, I don't want you to shuffle off this mortal coil too fast, you know." But I would sing her a song on my guitar called "I Just Don't Look Good Naked Anymore," you know. But I'd also sing to her, you know, "I come to the garden alone," and just be able to play for her there and be there. And my sisters were doing their part. We have three of us, and we rotated through. And I got to do things for my mom that she did for me when I was growing up. And we got very close spiritually. And I'll tell you what happened on the viewing. The rooms there, the open casket with this vehicle that my mom used to ride around in, sitting in the open casket. And one of her ladies from church came by holding a little four-year-old daughter. She can't have fun, just clinging to her. Can't have fun at a funeral. I don't know what this is, but it doesn't look like, you know, Playhouse, you know, at McDonald's or something. And I had my guitar there in the room, and I said, "Can I play you a song?" And the little girl shook her head no, and mom said yes. And so I sang "Marvelous Little Toy" by Peter, Paul, and Mary. And then a Raffy tune called "Baby Beluga in the Deep Blue Sea." And she got down on the floor, and I started singing, "5'2", eyes of blue. And then, "Don't mess with my blue suede shoes." And she's just dancing away here, you know. And when she leaves the funeral, she gives me a high five. She had a good time at the funeral. Now that is what my mother would have wanted me to do. And there is absolutely no way I could have predicted that back in December. My father, after having lost the love of his life, sort of began coasting. And he had some health problems. And he got checked in the hospital. My oldest sister had taken care of him for a little bit, and now it was my turn. And so I came down on a Wednesday, and I stayed there with him in the hotel room. Hospital room. And I remember it was on Friday, and I went down to get a change of shirt out of my car, and it was a change of watch. And the people in the hospital were coming and going, and I just happened to look at this guy coming towards me, and I said, "I wonder how he's going to play into all of this." I'd never thought that before. And I went on to the car, got my shirt, came back up. And I remember talking to my dad. I said, "Dad, do you want to live or do you want to die?" You know, just we had been having kind of a... And he said, Oh, well, you know. I said, no, really, I think a man's got a right to make that decision. He thought for a second. It was something he really thought about. He said, I think I want to live. I said, well, you might want to start acting like it. You know, he had been going to church, but he had really been going through the motions. Well, at 3:45 a.m., I hear the door open. I'm just in the little recliner. And here comes the nurse in, and I look over, and I can tell my dad's dead. You know, the mask is off. Don't know what that means. But I had been a caregiver, so I knew these things. And so all of a sudden, we had a non-resuscitation order, but it was a substitute head nurse who did not have that information. And so they called in the team to come in and resuscitate. And so I'm standing there watching this, and the nurse came to me and said, oh, no, you can't be here. I said, okay. And I stood in the doorway, and she said, no, you have to. And I said, well, where would you like me? And she started walking me over to this couch, and she said, and how are you doing? And I said, I'm doing fine. How are you doing? Because I've had somebody die on my watch as a caregiver. And she said, he was one of the special ones. And I said, he thought the same of you. I got to do my filial duty, to do things that my sisters didn't have to do. And finally, I mean, I remember right before on Friday, I said, besides, you know, if you're going to live, you got to live a little longer because I still owe you back for that furniture that we borrowed money for when we first got married. He said, don't worry. He said, you've paid for that multiple times over just this week. That was the last amends with my father. Now, I've got 15 other stories on this one page, but I don't have time to tell you all of them. But this is about the gifts of sobriety. I hope that in some little way, this talk will attract you towards the idea of practicing these principles in all our affairs, not become saints just because it's the easiest damn thing I've ever done. I'll finish up with this. Today I gave a gentleman a one-year medallion. He's in his 80s. Alcohol entered to his family, and alcoholism came into his family only 6 years ago. He was born again Christian, lovely family, successful businessman. He got into some pain pills and stuff and then started drinking. And then he got into that thing where he was drinking for a purpose, and he was drinking by sneaking around and all of that. And his wife, I got to meet her today for the first time. And she said to him, and I asked her, did you think about this beforehand? She said, no. She said to him, do you think God wants you to live this way? And it hit him. The switch flipped in him. When I was giving him his medallion, I said, the healing started then. All I did was came in and I took the bandage off the wound and we cleaned it up a little bit and freshened it up and sent him back out again. Now, 19 years ago, if you'd have told me that that would be some of the most meaningful things in my life, is to be able to do that, and that I would even have the capability of doing that, I don't know that I would have believed you. What is one life worth? I told you about the 100 and the 10 and the 5. But what is one life worth? And so for that, I think I will continue to be a service junkie. But I'm the one who gets all the benefits. Thank you for letting me share.